Welcome back to Issues, Etc. Here in the next 25 minutes, we're going to be talking with Dr. Kurt Marquardt about the limits of science. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Dr. Kurt Marquardt is Associate Professor of Systematic Theology at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. He's authored a chapter in this book called Reading God's World. His chapter is titled Sacred Cow or Sacred Calling Science. Dr. Marquardt, welcome back.
Thank you. Good to be back.
How do you respond to kind of the common notion now that what science can't see, observe, measure, verify experimentally doesn't exist? Science sets the limits of human knowledge in a real sense.
Well, that in itself would be a kind of materialist view, but science, physics itself has transcended that. You have today, physics has long gone beyond the directly observable. Quarks and quanta and things like that are not really observable.
So in other words, even the frontiers of science as we have them now are dealing with things that cannot be, they can be formulated as mathematical formulae.
Yes.
But they cannot be observed, measured, or anything.
Some of them, they are beyond direct observation, yes.
What's the difference between science and scientism?
Well, science is a perfectly honorable and right pursuit, namely to find out what this universe is like. Whereas scientism is making a religion out of science and making it some kind of an absolute ideology.
Describe that scientism in a little more detail, if you would. How does it become religion?
Well, my own view is that in the 19th century particularly, this particular view of science became a religion substitute for many of the educated people in Europe, the intelligentsia. So they replaced the lost certainties of Christian dogma with this new science, which was supposed to be a certain belief system. But that was a 19th century superstition. Now we know that science is basically is to be held with a light hand because it rests on empirical evidence. That is, it rests on probability. It does not rest on certainty.
Now, you have written this, and I'd like you to explain it, if you would, Dr. Marquardt. This comes at the end of your chapter, but I think it's very telling. You say, it is my own conviction that the most interesting scientific/philosophical problem today is that of the source of prodigious amount of information represented by biological organisms. What in the world do you mean?
Well, what I mean is this, that especially since 1963, it's been known that the hereditary mechanism, DNA, deoxyribonucleic acid, is really a vast information system. And information theory tells us that information does not arise from randomness, but is destroyed by randomness. And therefore, life could not have originated at random. And this is the great strength of today's intelligent design movement, which has even converted the British atheist, Anthony Flew, who at the age of 81 finally gave up his atheism.
He's at the very least become a deist.
Yes.
But certainly not a Christian.
No, although it's interesting that he says that there is more evidence for the resurrection than for any other so-called religious miracle. So I hope he's on the way.
You also write extensively in your chapter about Sir Karl Popper.
Yes.
Who kind of on the outs with everybody, science, the Marxists, whoever else he happened to run into. Tell us about Karl Popper and his ideas about science.
Well, Karl Popper has been considered the greatest philosopher of the 20th century. When he died, I was surprised to find out that he had been an advisor to Margaret Thatcher and her government in England. The Soviets hated him because he didn't just concentrate on science, but he also defended human freedom and strongly attacked Marxism and other captive systems like that. But Popper started out in the Jewish community in Vienna, I believe, in Austria, fled Hitler's tyranny, and I think ended up in New Zealand, and then ended up in London, at the University of London. But he was a very, very great thinker, and he specialized in philosophy of science.
Now, he advocated a certain approach to science that has run against the grain of almost everything nowadays. What was his view of science?
Well, actually, his view is widely accepted still. Namely, he resisted the idea that science is merely instrumentalism, that it's just a way of controlling nature, but it doesn't tell us anything objective. And Popper insisted that science, that truly great scientists have always been interested in finding out what the universe is like. And Einstein was not just interested in manipulation, he was interested in finding out what the cosmos is really like.
But for a while, you write, Einstein himself bought into the instrumentalist view that science can do nothing more than simply describe our observations, but we don't know what real really is. Did Einstein ever change his mind?
Apparently he did. Yeah, he regretted the subjectivism of his earlier view. He had long correspondence with Popper on that very subject, and Popper quotes him.
There are two events that take place at or near the Reformation. One of them is tied directly to the Reformation, that being a scriptural distinction being sharpened between the right and the left-hand kingdoms,
yeah.
The distinction between law and gospel. I want you to speak about that, if you would, and how it impacts science as a vocation.
Well, one of the great Reformation discoveries was the rediscovery of the dignity of lay people's work. For example, farmers, soldiers, office workers, factory workers, they used to be considered unspiritual. And the only spiritual worthy work was to be a monk or a nun. That nonsense was swept away by the Reformation, which restored the dignity of every Christian's daily calling. And that includes science. So that's the enormous significance there.
Now, the other one is the so-called Copernican Revolution.
Yes.
A change in the way that at the very least, the solar system we inhabit was viewed. And you say that unlike their counterparts in the Reformation, the Lutherans had no problem with the Copernican Revolution. Tell us about it.
Well, that's an interesting thing. The Vatican condemned Copernicanism, but not for any biblical reasons, but basically because they were hanging on to old Greek philosophy. Whereas the Reformed were biblical fundamentalists or biblicists, literalists in a bad sense, and they thought that was unbiblical. But the Lutherans, it was at Lutheran universities that Copernicanism flourished in the 16th century.
And why is that?
Because of the distinction of law and gospel and the distinction of the two kingdoms, that science has a perfect right to formulate on the basis of scientific evidence the nature of the universe.
And back to Karl Popper, you talk about how he wants to speak of three worlds.
Yes.
And how, and therefore the limits of science, and as you say, it gets science and theology minding their own business, really, in a lot of ways. World one, what is it, what are these three worlds that Popper talks about?
Well, for him, world one is the subjective world of some individual human being. World two world one is the material world. World two is a subjective world. And world three is the cultural world. And the reason I like that is there are some of these postmodernists floating around that no scientist can respect. But they hold that all convictions are really basically subjective. But Popper very neatly points out that when an idea has come into the public view, then other people can draw conclusions from it which never occurred to the original inventor of the idea. So that means that the cultural, the world of ideas, has a certain objective existence, and that different minds can participate in it. So there's an objectivity to it. It's not just subjectivism. That, to me, is a great strength of Popper's suggestion there.
We're talking with Dr. Kurt Marquardt about the limits of science. He's associate professor of systematic theology at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. He's authored a chapter in the book called Reading God's World. The chapter is titled Sacred Cow or Sacred Calling. Our call-in number is 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. If you have a question or comment as we talk about the limits of science, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. I had my interest sparked by listening to a radio interview with a physicist, a quantum physicist, a proponent of what's now being called string theory. And so I bought the guy's book. It's called The Elegant Universe. I'm about three quarters of the way through this, and it's kind of rough going, Dr. Marquardt, because
yes.
It involves a lot of very abstract thinking. I am no mathematician. He's trying to take very complicated mathematical postulates about the nature of the universe, great and small, and put them in lay terms. So I am slugging through this book.
Yes, it's quite an adventure.
One of the things that I find fascinating about this is the smaller the things that are observed by science, the more problems they run into with trying to square it with all of the accepted theories about how the physical world ought to work.
Yeah.
Now, here is a quote that you have in your chapter, and I want you to explain the significance of this. This is a quote from P.W. Atkins. Science will be forced to admit defeat if it has to stop at a seed of any size. That is, the severity of the criterion that science sets apart for itself. If we are to be honest, then, we have to accept that science will be able to claim complete success only if it achieves what many might think impossible, accounting for the emergence of everything from absolutely nothing. Not almost nothing, not a subatomic dust-like speck, but absolutely nothing, nothing at all, not even empty space. Why do you quote Atkins at this point?
Because it strikes me as a good example of an absolutism that really makes science impossible. They want an absolute dogmatism, and that is simply not what science is. Science is a good practical discipline showing, on the basis of common sense and observation, what this cosmos really is like.
So are we dealing with two diametrically opposed worldviews, if we put science in the best possible light, not scientism, but science, as a sacred calling, and the so-called Christian worldview?
Well, there really is no, contrary to what is being written today, there is really no relation between theology and science, because they follow entirely different methods and entirely different authorities and subject matter. But since we are made to inhabit this physical universe, science is a perfectly legitimate, honorable subject, also for Christians. And there's nothing wrong with it, as long as it's not made into some absolute dogmatism and religion. And this is, again, the greatness of Popper. He refuses to regard it as this dogmatic ideology, which is a 19th century superstition.
So let's deal with a few particulars, realms of science. In the area of biology, Darwinism, or something close to Darwinism, has held sway for 100 years.
Yes.
Is it science?
Strictly speaking, the Darwinian thing deals with past events, and therefore it's more of more history than science, and history is notoriously unscientific. So genuine science can be, scientific theories can be tested in the laboratory, or mathematically in some concrete way. But to say that something happened 10 million years ago is not really testable.
Does Darwinian thought suffer from the same, what you call dogmatic absolutism? That is, where the physicist might say, we've got to probe smaller and smaller until we find the smallest thing, and we're not going to really be honest unless we find out that it's nothing at all. the Darwinist theory nowadays says we've got to go back until we find not the origin of life, but chaos itself.
Yes, and the dogmatic Darwinians today insist that that you can't introduce supernatural causes, such as a great mind, but the interesting thing is that Darwinism has today fallen into conflict with genuine science, namely information theory, because information theory shows that randomness does not create but destroys information, as you can easily illustrate with misspellings of various kinds.
Now, on this whole, where does information then fall? Because this is key to understanding your point. Some people might say, look, information is just energy and matter organizing itself in some way.
Right. However, one of the great founders of information theory, Norbert Wiener, another escapee from Hitler's terror, wrote in 1948 in his book on cybernetics that information is information and not matter or energy. It's a different category, different kettle of fish altogether. And matter and energy do not explain information. Because if you ever built a castle on the sand at the beach, the next wave did not improve it. And the great British astronomer, Sir Fred Hoyle, who used to be an atheist, no longer is, but he writes that to expect information content of this kind to arise, he says, you may as well think that a tornado striking a junkyard will produce a 747 jumbo jet. It's simply not in the cards.
Let's talk then in the last few minutes about intelligent design. You mentioned it before. William Dembski is mentioned in your chapter as well. He's been a guest on the program as well as other advocates of intelligent design. Is this friend or foe, intelligent design, to the Christian theology?
Pardon me. Well, it really has nothing to do with Christian theology, and that is its strength. The enemies of intelligent design have tried to portray it as just another way in which the creationists are trying to smuggle themselves into schools. But intelligent design does not rest, like creationism, does not rest on Genesis. It's not dealing with scripture at all. It's a purely scientific notion that information is not a measure of randomness, but information is a measure of improbability. And the randomness destroys information. Therefore, if life is information, it cannot have arisen at random. That's a purely scientific argument.
Now, some will fault intelligent design, saying, look, for exactly the same reason others fault it. Christians might fault it for saying, look, it just doesn't go far enough. Why not? If you're going to talk about intelligent design, why not talk about the designer?
Well, but on what basis would one do that? Intelligent design can only tell us, and that's basically what St. Paul writes in Romans 1, that it's possible from an observation of nature to come to the conclusion that there must be a creator. And that's all that intelligent design does. There must be some sort of creator, but what he is like, we can't learn from nature. Nature is, as it were, full of the footprints of God, but you don't know anybody from footprints.
Is the fault, given the limited nature of that, what theologians would call natural revelation that Paul talks about there in Romans 1,
yeah.
This is something I found our listeners may be confused on, too. Is the fault with the revelation itself or with our reading of natural revelation? In other words, did God leave false footprints that look like old Earth, that look like fossil record going back hundreds of millions of years, that look like evolution, or are we just misreading an accurate account?
Yes, it's basically human misreading. But then again, there are so many issues involved, and it's not easy to determine the exact facts. But the interesting thing is that when Mount St. Helens exploded there some years ago, the deposits later would have been aged at millions of years, when actually they happened in a few hours.
How would you then evaluate, given what you said about intelligent design, how would you evaluate the attempts that are older than ID as attempts to mix, conflate science, or at least Darwinian science, and the biblical account, scientific creationism, it's sometimes called?
Well, I criticize it in that article too, that if you try to mix up some elements of science and elements of theology, your whole thing will be out of date within a few years anyway, because science is constantly advancing, and the Bible does not give us the specific nature of the universe. We have to learn that from science. So it's mixing two things that don't really belong together.
So is this exactly what happened there at the time of the Reformation, while the Copernican Revolution is going on? The reformers on the Lutheran side look at Copernicus's new model for the solar system and said, wow, since the Bible is not a book describing the nature of the physical universe per se, this seems to jive nicely with what we observe and with what Scripture teaches.
Yes, and Scripture, like the language of preaching, uses ordinary language. So sunset, sunrise, and even the most sophisticated physicist, when he talks to his wife about the sunset, he doesn't say, look how beautifully the earth is turning.
Finally, and very briefly, Dr. Marquardt, what about the is and the ought of science? Science can tell us what is. Can it tell us what ought to be or what we ought to do?
No, it can't, because it can merely tell us the physical constitution of the universe. So moral reasoning has to come from another source.
What happens when someone tries to derive moral reasoning from science alone?
Well, then finally, anything becomes permissible, whatever we can do, because science is basically methodology. And we can devise all sorts of ways of depriving somebody of a life. But whether the person ought to be deprived of his life, science cannot determine. That rests on totally different grounds. And therefore, science has to be subject to a strong system of morality.
Dr. Kurt Marquardt is Associate Professor of Systematic Theology at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. He's authored this chapter in the book Reading God's World. His chapter is titled Sacred Cow or Sacred Calling. Dr. Marquardt, thank you for being our guest.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.